Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. Today we travel back to Melbourne, Australia, having had previous conversations with Ben Samield, now the CIO of the Australia Future Fund, and David Neal, CEO of IFM, the infrastructure powerhouse. Another Australian force to be reckoned with is not found in their sporting domain. It's in the world of their pensions, specifically the Australian Super, Australia's largest super fund. And at its helm, the CIO, and I think the CIO for almost 20 years, is Mark Delaney, our guest today. So Mark, 8 o'clock in the morning in London, 5 o'clock in Melbourne. Welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Hey, thank you, Simon. Delighted to be here.
Well, it's great. You are the largest, Australia's largest super fund. In a minute, we'll talk about what exactly that means. If I've got my research right, you manage over Australian dollar 340 billion of retirement savings on behalf of 3.4 million members. And that today's exchange rate of 1.46 Aussie to the US, that's about 230 billion US dollars. Was I right about that, by the way, Mark, before I march on?
Numbers are right, Simon. Well done.
Good.
How's your investment background?
Well, we always talk about populations, and I like to think that I'm quite good at playing population games, but I had to go and look up Australia's population, and the number 27 million people came back, and it's like, wow, when did that change from the 15 million that was sort of in my mind probably since childhood? And then I had a little look at what percentage of the population is adult, and I see that's about 21 million, so that's about 75% of the population, similar to the US and a lot of Western countries, which made me think, just to start with, the West has got this aging dilemma. How does Australia think about the dependency ratio and all of the problems that come with what the West is dealing with?
Yes, so superannuation is really an exercise of trying to deal with that. It started in the 1980s into the 1990s, whereby people set aside 3% of their salary to go into a compulsory superannuation or pension account. And that's grown to 12% now. And the objective really is to reduce the burden on the old age pension and allow people who go into retirement to be able to have a much more decent standard of living. So it's been an admirable objective and it's worked really well. It works in a narrow sense because it allows us to have a much greater pool of retirement savings for people, but also works in a macro sense because Australia used to run a very big current account deficit and had higher interest rates than those in the US, for example. And since the super system really became mature and commodity prices went up, I must say, it's actually been a capital exporter sometimes. So it's been a dramatic change in Australia's history because you go back the previous 100 years and Australia was always a capital importer.
Yes. I mean, when I started in the business a long time ago, you know, we used to buy high-yield Australian government bonds because they were high-yield, certainly relative to today's standards, and deficits were the norm. It was a classic sort of UK-style, weak currency deficit-running country. And boy, it's a different picture today.
Completely different. It's been quite a phenomenal change. And the size of the savings pool is really large relative to the size of the economy. So we get to the stage now whereby Australian pension plans and us, the Australian super, are starting to deploy more capital overseas than what they can deploy in Australia. So you're starting to see Australia become a capital exporter, partly through the pension system.
Well, we're going to come back to a number of those because they're really important. One of the things that is different about the way you're organized is the Australian Super is run only for members. So you don't pay profits or dividends to shareholders. So the money goes back to the fund. And I'd like to understand later on what you think that means to sort of compounding returns. But just before we dive into a lot of those, give us the elevator summary of your route to the top.
Yeah. Oh, route to the top. Well, I started that studying economics and econometrics in the late 70s, early 80s, then went to work for the Australian government in the Treasury Department. And I actually spent a lot of time working in the balance of payments section during the balance of payments crisis. As you said, it was a volatile country at that stage, and there were big issues. And then I came out with financial deregulation, came out of that organisation, worked for National Mutual, then AXA, in investment strategy and funds management. And then in 2000, went to work for an industry fund, which is a defined contribution pension plan, who had about $3 billion Australian dollars of assets. And I went there as the investment manager. And the guy who hired me was a person called Paul Costello, who went on to start the Future Fund in Australia and also New Zealand Super. So a great person, no longer with us, sadly. He had a habit of selecting high-quality talent, and I was one of the less talented ones, but I've done okay despite all that. So I started there, and then about 2003, I became the CEO of that pension plan. And in 2006, that one, the Australian Retirement Fund led by Ian Silk, who became the CEO of Australian Super, and another small fund, FinSuper, merged to create Australian Super. So I've basically been running the investments pretty much since 2000, all the way through. And in that time, we started out, in my experience, at $3 billion and now $340 billion. And so it's been a phenomenal period, a phenomenal experience. And I've been lucky to work with a lot of great people.
Yeah, and you won't say it, but outside of private fund management firms, 20-year career holding that top position is really unusual. So hopefully I'm not the kiss of death here saying that.
Yes, so do I, actually.
But there is an interesting point I wanted to make, not about Australia, and that's in relation to the UK and lessons learned. As you may know, the UK is the second largest pension pool in the world, and we had David Schwimmer of LSEG, you know, talk about the fragmentation of the UK pension industry that, if we're going to get it right, needs to draw together and consolidate a lot. What lessons could the UK learn about consolidating pension pools?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So when I came into Super back in 2000 out of commercial funds management, what I couldn't get over was how many pension plans there were, and they were all doing the same thing. They all had the same advisors. They all had the same member communications people, and their portfolios weren't that different. Now, the UK's a little different to that, but there was thousands of them, thousands and thousands, and it was never going to be a sustainable solution. The only reason that existed was because there wasn't any competition. But in 2005, the government allowed people to pick their own pension plan. So if you didn't like the one your employer put you into, you can go and get another one. Take your money out of Australian Super, go down the road to another one. And so that's how business works. Competition leads to the winners getting bigger and the losers getting smaller. And that's what happened in the Australian market, was that competition actually was the biggest trigger for Australian Super to be created. We said, as soon as competition comes, the biggest are going to win. They're going to have the most capability. So the sooner you get bigger, the more advantage you'll have, and that will generate its own momentum. So in the UK, there are lots of pension plans all doing small things, and you might argue subscale, but you'll need competition as well, the ability for people to move between them and market their different products. Because if you can't get competition, all you've got as an incentive to consolidate is regulatory pressure, which is useful, but not as good as market forces.
And from an investment standpoint, what would you say is the greatest advantage of that scale?
I think scale allows you to have more skilled people, more skilled people. When we were small, we were always scratching around with ideas, half developed, not enough skill to execute. Who do we find to do that? And now you've got more people together, you can basically get on with doing it properly.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. Schroders is a $950 billion public-private global asset management business. Built to deliver long-term client value, Schroders focuses their business on growing into areas where there is greater demand, private markets, bespoke solutions, and wealth management, and where they can better serve clients. Schroders take a long-term perspective and a leadership position in sustainability. With a 220-year history of successful adaptation and innovation, Schroders have always focused on serving clients. Remember, capital is at risk when investing. Now, you just touched on giving folks in Australia choice. And the thing that struck me as I looked through your materials was, of course, you have various options, of which I think most people opt for the balanced route, which isn't surprising. But, you know, financial education is generally poor, and financial management is tough. How do people who are not familiar with the financial world really arrive at an educated decision?
Well, the Australian system's got two foundations. The first one is a default system. So AustralianSuper is a trustee for all these people. So we'll pick what we think is the best option for people to have, investment option, on balance, on average. And that's what we call our balance plan. It's our default option. So most people don't choose. They just say, look, I've picked AustralianSuper. That's enough work. You go and work out what's the right investment option to apply. Some people who want to take a closer interest in their investments then say, no, I want to be high growth, or I've got a financial planner who wants me to do something different. But for most people, they'll let the organization choose that outcome.
Okay, so I'm clear about that. Let's just talk about how you're organized in terms of the board and the governance, because CIO means different things in different entities.
Yeah, so start at the board. The board's a representation of employers and employee representatives, plus one independent. They then appoint the CEO, and the CEO, in effect, apart from maybe the chief investment officer, appoints the rest of the organization. So it's run like a typical fund management business.
We all work around benchmarks in this industry. You will have your benchmarks, but I've noticed you've tacked away from it at times. Just tell me a little bit about how much you can deviate from your benchmark and under what circumstances.
So we think we're in the money-making business. And the more money we make, the better we've done for people. So we're going to look for all our avenues to make money. And asset allocation, moving away from the benchmark, is one of those avenues. And so we've had a long history of being active in asset allocation on roughly a 1 to a 3 year horizon, using a framework which has moved around over the years, but basically reflects two levers. The first one being how you see the outlook is, the economic outlook, how policy is going and whatever, and then what does value tell you? Clearly, the best time to buy stocks is when the economy is really poor and the prices are really low. And clearly, the reverse will be the time to not to own stocks is when the economy is really full, inflation is rising, and valuations are very expensive. So we sort of have this sliding scale and look at allocation within that framework. And we've looked to try and add value doing that active asset allocation, bonds, equities, currencies, what we call mid-risk assets, which is infrastructure and property and like, and have done that pretty consistently for the last 20 years. And then there's traditional stock selection in the other asset classes, et cetera.
Always sounds very coherent when one talks about an investment philosophy, and the problem comes when the rubber meets the road. We've got a more expensive US market than it's been historically, in fact, quite a lot more expensive, and we've got a lot of cheap markets historically, such as, you know, the UK, such as parts of Asia, Europe, etc., all for reasons that are always obvious at the time until they're not obvious, because of course markets have discounted and possibly borrowed, in the case of the US, from the future. How do you then grapple with the fact that under that very clear statement, it's a lot more muddy?
Yeah, it is a lot more muddy. Sometimes it's really clear, but you need a lot of courage. Like if you're buying stocks in 2009, you know, the unemployment's at 9%, they're throwing the kitchen sink at it, and valuations are 15 times or 14 times, something like that. It looks like a good time to buy if you were just dropped in over a helicopter from Mars. But if you were there from 2007 to 2009, you're probably shell-shocked, traumatized, and wondering whether HSBC going under is going to be the end of the world for you and the financial system. So the most obvious times are when you need the most courage, and the hardest times is when you need the least courage, but you need a lot more thought. And this is kind of in the environment we're in, whereby you've got a narrow and expensive market led by a new technology theme, which looks like it could go on for a bit longer yet. And valuations dispersion is quite widespread between stocks in the market, and fund managers are struggling to cope with that style of market. We've had them before, and they'll go on for a while and then they'll stop. And this will be one of those. It'll go on for a while and then it'll stop.
So because nobody rings a bell at the bottom of a bear market or the top, and you're looking and you're seeing these pockets of value, is yours therefore an incremental approach? I mean, what have you been doing in the last few months when you rightly recognize that there is value emerging in other quarters?
There's two bits. The first one is how you organize your equity portfolio, which is where all the action's really been below the surface rather than at the top line level of the equity market. And you've seen some rotation into cyclical and quality stocks as the market's got onto the low interest rate theme. And you wonder whether the fizz has come out permanently or temporarily out of the AI technology period. And then there's your equity market as a whole. Trying to time and manage these changing rotations within the equity market is very difficult. In our experience, we've struggled to really make consistent money out of it. You know, these themes come and they go and they change pretty quickly. And you're best to leave that to the managers who just pick them on a stock basis. But to try a macro-style approach to equity market composition is tricky. In an aggregate sense, we think that probably the low interest rates will be good for the market as long as you don't have a recession. And so, therefore, we've been inclined to try and nibble away at these pullbacks and just buy a little bit more.
Now, in the equity world, you can go active, you can go passive. I'm imagining you do both. I wonder when you go active.
Now, we start with trying to be always active. We're in the business of making money for members. So if we can make money above a passive portfolio, we should do it. And in today's marketplace, whereby the market is very concentrated, it's probably a good grounds to go active than go passive. But you've seen last year and the year before, actually pick the last 12 months, say 3/4 of global equity managers have underperformed and by a big margin. Last 2 years have really been years for passive. You know, it's been a concentrated market, expensive, and most equity managers diversify away from the larger cap stocks into the smaller ones and more broadly, and that's led to underperformance. But that won't go on forever. And so, as you were alluding to before, sooner or later, the market will start to normalize, and so you want to be active. So we like the idea of being active. We like it as a philosophy because we've been typically pretty good at it.
And what do you try and instill in your team when they're looking for external managers?
Oh, very good question. I've looked at external managers forever. Like it feels like my whole life. I used to say people, process, and performance, but I used to say now it's people, people, and people. You need to find people who have got the ability to select the best performing stocks. It's innate in some of these people. They need to operate in a people environment which is supportive and the organization culture is strong around how they operate, and they need to have a solid team of good people around them, whereby they can feed up ideas and there's no big egos involved. So the people issues are absolutely dominant. And I often say that it's really important when you go and hire an external manager to walk around the floor, walk around the office where they all sit and get to see how they talk to each other, how they interact, how free is the exchange of ideas and whatever. It tells you a lot about the environment. So the people environment and the quality of the people is absolutely the most important thing. Every manager's got a really good process. Every manager's got a robust organization to make the A-list, and every manager's got consultant tick-offs. But only half of those are going to win. And so then it becomes down to the judgment. Like hiring a fund manager is like hiring your own staff. In the end, you've got to look at all these different people and say, I think they've got the skills we need for the job we've got.
And I know that we all rush to get simple conclusions, but if over the years you've made, which you have done, obviously everybody does, mistakes. What's the red flag? What do you share with your team that is the likely thing over which they might trip?
The first thing is every investment manager makes mistakes. I don't think there's any great investment manager who hasn't made mistakes. And so you have to be able to handle mistakes, otherwise you can't make it. The stress of the job just eats you up inside. The second thing is that when you have made a mistake, because a lot of the investment managers are analysts by nature, they want to work out why they made the mistake. And often you know you're wrong before you worked out why you're wrong. And so my piece of advice is when you think you're wrong, just accept it and worry about why later on, because you otherwise you'll keep on losing money while you work out why that happens. So you need people to say, hang on, I think you're wrong here. And you'll go, yeah, I think I am, and accept it. But you can't work out why you're wrong often for quite some time.
And that brings me to that really difficult thing for investment managers is thinking you might be wrong and then having the perspective and the guts to cut your position. And how do you possibly advise people on, because that's the sort of the greed and fear, that's the science and the nature all fighting each other.
Well, you know, hope isn't an investment strategy. So when you're hanging on hoping it comes better, you tell all your staff that hope isn't an investment strategy. You've got to have more logic than that. And then if it hasn't worked, there's got to be a reason why it hasn't worked. You just haven't worked it out yet. But hanging on and hoping generally doesn't work. If you're the person who's hanging on and hoping, it's sometimes hard to stop hanging on.
Yeah, I think that is a supposedly Chinese proverb, which is hope is the mother of all stupidity. So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below. Let's talk about these other asset classes, which are so important and which you can definitely have important representations in your portfolio because of your size and because of your timelines. PE. There is an argument, there's a lot of indigestion right now for all the reasons that we're aware. Is that creating opportunity, or do you actually think this is an industry that got too big too quick?
I don't know about too big too quick. I've been investing in PE since 2000, and I've heard too big too quick twice before. And so this time could be right, but I've also heard it twice before. People have indigestion, but generally, we just actually had a meeting about how should we allocate to PE from all of our senior investors. Should you allocate consistently or should you try and time the markets in and out? Timing is difficult. Vintage year selection is very difficult. But as a general rule, you want to be consistent and maybe just add a bit more when PE is out of fashion and be a bit cautious when PE and ventures well in fashion. So 22, PE was in fashion. 21, 22, big returns. I think venture did 100% in 22. That's when you want to be cautious, when PE is hot and really in fashion. And now 24, is PE broken? Can it handle the amount of debt, et cetera? It's a bit out of fashion, not completely out of fashion. Prices aren't that cheap, but a little bit out of fashion. So I think there's a reason to add a little bit more in now than what you'll normally do.
So then these other asset classes, you, I think, have an ownership stake in IFM. IFM Australia is actually a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. We're very happy to have them on board. But how do you think about infrastructure in your portfolio? My two specific questions are, what does it give you and how do you size it?
Yeah, IFM is a great firm. We've been investing for a long time with them and actually we're involved in creating them. So infrastructure, I used to use the phrase, it's the ballast in the boat. So you've got, rather than rock from one side of the boat to the other with stocks going up and down, you want to have this ballast in the middle of the boat, which can generate pretty strong returns, but not slosh one way or the other too quickly. So we like those characteristics. We like the characteristics of it being reasonably defensive, having growth, and not having overly complicated business models. And so it doesn't require a lot of management expertise to really drive those businesses. So if you can get them, they're very good assets. They did get very keenly sought after and very expensive. In the case of the UK, some of these regulated assets were selling at very big premiums. But in general, they're good businesses if well run, and we like them. And they are the third biggest asset class in the portfolio, and we've got currently 15% of the balance plan in infrastructure. So we've been a big investor and a long-time investor in it.
Got it. So the thing that rocks the boat, as opposed to giving it ballast, can be property. That's another area that I know you've written about. Tell me a little bit about how you're thinking about it and where you're thinking about it.
Yeah, so property's been hit by digital disruption. It's a thing which is affecting the whole world, how the world's digitalizing. And as we're doing this call, it's a classic example of that. Property had it first in retail, he's now got it in office. And both those things are really a manifestation of the change in digital world. And it's materially impacted upon property revenues as people have found cheaper ways to go about the activity which property used to provide. And the best properties are the ones who are benefiting from digital, whether it's industrial warehousing or data centers or whatever, whatever. So digital disruption is still a big theme in property. I don't think that's going away in a hurry. If you look at the markets in order, the UK looks like it's repriced the most, particularly in office.
And you mean, sorry, just to interrupt you, you mean reprice has come down enough to be interesting?
Come down enough to have a look at. Not sure you're doing it, but come down a fair bit. In the US, it still looks pretty distressed. You know, a combination of lots of vacancies and high interest rates still very, and there's lots of distressed sales there in the US. And in Australia, the market's still struggling as well. So I think for office globally is still pretty difficult. Retail looks a bit better as internet penetration rates are starting to level out a little bit. And then the new sectors in property are reasonably hot as people are piled out of the old ones into the new ones. So it's still it hasn't got a green light. I wouldn't call it the green light. It might have a yellow, but it's still pretty difficult.
And what's your allocation today to global property?
4%.
Okay. And how high has that been?
We might have had 9 at one stage.
And could you see yourself getting back there in the right conditions?
It's hard to see from here.
Now, hedge funds, we've had some super allocators who said, can't pay those fees, never going there. What's your view?
We used to have hedge funds in the 2000s, and then I sold them all prior to the financial crisis. I don't mind them, what they're trying to do. If they've just got the same active management strategies as what I've got in them in the other 97% of my portfolio at higher fees, I sort of wonder, what am I getting? The one advantage they did have in the last couple of years when they've done very well is they were floating rate investment. This is an interesting theme. So how do you handle inflation in the portfolio? You need floating rate investments. So private credit's floating rate, and so are hedge funds floating rate, and so are cash. So when cash rates go up a lot in the system, those strategies which have cash plus style benchmarks do pretty well. So you've had 2 years where the environment's really suited them, you know, cash plus and whatever. And they struggled, interestingly, when cash rates were down at 1 because they were cash plus and they were earning 4% less to start with. But a lot of the improvement has really been that the base rates have gone up more so maybe than the alpha being generated has gone up that substantially. So there's lots of clever people out there, but generally we don't have them in the portfolio.
Got it. And are there any other parts of your portfolio that we haven't touched on that you are quite enthusiastic about?
I'm pretty balanced at the current time. I'm a balanced investor in a balanced plan. There's not really that many screaming opportunities. As we started at the outset, you know, stocks are expensive, but the outlook looks okay. Fixed income still looks okay. Even with the rally in bonds, it could still do a fair bit better from here. There's the potential that some of these more cyclical strategies could go okay if the economy starts to benefit from lower interest rates. No, it's pretty balanced, I think.
So the one, you're sitting in Australia. We all know about the commodity underpinnings of the Australian economy. Does that mean you just don't allocate to commodities, or do you think that they can play at the right time in the cycle quite an important incremental role?
Yeah, commodities used to be one of those inflation hedges and didn't do that well in the last inflation period. I still think they're relevant, but these commodity indices are heavily influenced by the oil market. 2/3 of the oil. So you're not buying iron or you're not buying an AI digital commodity, you're buying oil. And that will give you pause to think. But we take our commodity exposure in Australian equity stocks, BHP, Rio Tinto, we take iron ore. They're diversified commodity miners. So we buy them rather than buy commodities per se.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more, or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market. We haven't had a big commodity company on the podcast, but we're going to. But, you know, they weren't good capital allocators. They got traumatized. They appear to have become better. Big cash flows coming off them. Are these temporarily better behaved beasts?
We own a fair bit of some of these businesses, so I'll be a little bit careful as to what I say. There has been a history, as you said, of allocating capital poorly and at the top of the market and having excessive cash and trying to work out where to put it. I think they're better behaved, but they need to maintain that discipline for the long term.
Very diplomatic. Tell me, 20 years of being CIO, what do you think has changed most in the way you approach markets?
Not much, actually. I think markets are still the same as what they always were. There's the cyclical factors. There's always structural themes. Now it's technology. It might have been financial services previously and whatever. And there's heaps of market information. I think the last point's probably the most significant is that you need to insulate yourself. You need to have just the right amount of market information, but not too much. Whereas before, you used to try and have to search out market information. Now it's everywhere. You go to the US, everyone's got the CNBC on their TV in their office and whatever. It's you get it 24 hours a day. I doubt that you can make good decisions having all that deluge of short-term information being sent at you. You need to have a longer-term horizon. But you can't close your ears to what the markets are saying. So you need to be able to hear enough but not go deaf.
Let's pause on that because it's so interesting. Information overload, difficult to the noise from signal. What are your disciplines that make Mark Delaney better at that than he might otherwise be?
It's partly lucky being in Australia because all the big action in the US time zone, I'm asleep for. So I don't go up and watch the markets overnight. I'll just get up in the morning and see what happened and get a report, like reading a Monday morning newspaper or something. Everybody in the world now looks at the FT and Bloomberg. There's not an investor in the world who doesn't get the same information. So I look at that. I look at other things like CNBC just to see how the US is reporting US news. And then I'll look at what people say about the market news. But in the end, you just need a little bit, but not too much.
Got it. And some say extraordinary insights from guests on the Money Maze podcast as well, but who am I to say?
Oh, well, of course. This is critical.
Tell me, when we started, I mentioned the fact that because of your structure, you don't pay out dividends and don't do buybacks, etc., which means money goes back in the fund. What do you think that means to performance over time? Have you actually calculated it?
So we're in a competitive business where we compare our performance after costs to everybody else. And so if your costs can be lower, that's a head start. So I've philosophically got a framework that you want to do all the easy things to win in performance before you have to start using skill. So you want to manage your tax carefully. You want to manage your liquidity. You want to manage your fees and expenses and everything else. So you want to manage your business very carefully and then use skill on top of that platform. But to say that I'm going to have enough skill to compensate for spending a lot of costs is a pretty tricky equation. And the final bit is when you have a look at pension plans around the world and you plot them up with their costs and their performance, there's no correlation. It's completely random. And so some plans have high costs and low performance, some plans have low costs and high performance, and some are in between. So that suggests to me that you can be a good performer whilst managing costs. And that therefore feeds back into the how we philosophically think about making money.
So the essential ingredient in that mix is your quality of the people that you hire and retain. And, you know, we all know there's a bid for a smart person to go to, you know, a new shiny investment organization. How do you think about paying and retaining in a tough competitive market for talent?
Investment people are pretty good with numbers. So if you want to hire someone, they're not going to come to your job for less than what they're getting at their previous job. Despite all the opportunities you've got, maybe their previous firm's looking like it's going to close down, they might move. But by and large, that doesn't work. So you have to pay market-based remuneration. Otherwise, people won't come, irrespective of us being a for-purpose investor with strong cash flows and all the other attractiveness. And then the same thing for retaining. If you don't offer career opportunities and competitive remuneration, people will leave as well. So you just need to be on the ball about that. But you don't need to overpay either. You just need to get that balance right.
And key to that retention is creating the right culture. We've just released an interview with Colm Kelleher, who's the chair of UBS, who interestingly talked about the trauma in some detail of the great financial crisis to which you alluded. But he also talks about culture starting at the top. Tell me a little bit how you think you have developed and sustained a culture that makes it attractive for people to want to join and stay with you.
Yeah, I think there's a few things which work in our culture. Every firm will tell you how good their culture is. So I think we're a very good one. The first one is that the sense of mission, making money for others, is what motivates most investment people, a chance to contribute to others, particularly others who are less advantaged than they are. And we've got 3.3 million members. You know, most of them are on very modest incomes, and you're trying to make a really big difference to what their retirement is. So if they retire on old age pension, or you can make 20% more for them, that makes a big difference if you think about people you know and whatever. So the mission matters. The second thing is, I think, a bit of humility that no one's a master of the universe here. We're all just doing a job and trying to deliver results. And so have a culture which I like to say that no one at Australian Super gets ahead by putting somebody else down. You just can't get ahead by making fools of others. You have to contribute in a way which makes people better. And then leadership matters. You have to lead, so sort of exhibit your culture. And the final bit really is, while investments is a, sort of a sexy part of the field and whatever, what makes you think that the person who handles a member inquiry about a spouse who's just died is not doing a more important job than you are? So you just really need to get the basics right. Is it's not your money, it's other people's money. They've hired you and you're getting paid much more than what they earn to do a job for them. And so I think that values really makes a difference.
Yeah, that's not something that people perhaps spend enough time thinking about. So that's well said. I'm going to move to some closing questions. How do you deal in what can be a very stressful business? How do you deal with that stress?
Yeah, it is stressful, particularly when you're not making money. It's very stressful. There's a few things. The first one is that you just need to be aware that the stress exists and then say, I'm going to have to deal with this somehow. I'm going to have to take time out, go for a run, make sure I eat properly. The same way if you're a professional sports person and you're going to play a football match or something, you have to then have a program for managing the stresses put on your body by it. And investments is the same sort of thing, but it's mental stress. So I'll do exercise. I'll try and be careful what I eat. I'll manage what I drink. If you had a bad time, I won't have 5 drinks and think that's going to solve the problem. It just doesn't work. Maybe I've got a bit older. And no one dies. The truth is no one dies. And if you relax, you'll actually be better than if you get stressed. So no one dies and you just need to live with it.
I'm told that you're a very keen surfer.
Poor surfer, but a keen surfer, yeah.
What's the appeal of this sport, which I have tried very, very badly to do?
I played a lot of sports. I played lots of sports over the time. I think surfing's right up there. It's hard to master. Maybe that's why people like golf. It's hard to master. When you paddle out into the ocean, everything else gets left behind. So if you talk about how do you manage stress or whatever, when you're out there sitting there waiting for a wave and whatever, you're not worrying about what's happening in the US equity market or do we have enough bonds or something. You're entirely focused on the problem at hand. So it just removes everything else out of your system. And by the time you come in sort of wet, panting, and either frustrated or quite proud of yourself, your whole day is just that much better. So it just makes your life better. So life is better by surfing.
Got it. Now, switching tack, we have a lot of young people around the world who very fortunately listen to this. What advice would you give to young people thinking about the financial industry?
Do what you love. Do what you love. If you enjoy investing, enjoy how money moves around, do it. Be curious. Do your own numbers and don't believe what other people tell you.
Excellent. Okay, so my final question is that you come from a country that produces some gorgeous wine, although obviously heat is a problem. We had a guest on a couple of years ago, Dr. Christina Maguire, who runs Elephant Asset Management, a niche EM fund, and she very generously gave me a bottle of Hentscher Mount Edelston Shiraz, which I'm yet to drink because I know it's a very beautiful bottle of wine. If you've had a good surf and the markets are treating you okay, what's the bottle of wine you want to drink?
Oh, I'll drink a McLaren Vale or something like that, or a Heathcote Shiraz. You won't go astray there.
Great. Well, Mark, that's been a super conversation to travel to another part of the world who have a different way of doing things. There are lessons for the UK. I have written down 3 things. One is that as the UK particularly thinks about consolidating its pension industry, scale allows you to have more skilled talent available to you, number one. Number two, you are stating something that I certainly forget, that hope is not an investment strategy. And thirdly, because infrastructure, and I sit on investment committees and don't see infrastructure very often, although obviously it's a growing institutional asset class, is that you describe infrastructure as the ballast in the boat, which I like as a term, and I might find myself using and then forgetting it actually came from you. So, Mark, it's been super having you here. You're allowed to go. You could probably even make the beach right now because we started at 5 and it's 10 to 6. But it's been super meeting you digitally, and I hope we get to meet, physically in due course.
Beautiful, Simon. I've loved it. Thanks very much.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.